get started. Welcome to your anti-procrastination first aid kit. I will read Norwescon's description of this panel, and then our panelists can introduce themselves. Do you love to write, but don't get as much writing done as you'd like to? Conquer your fears and your rough draft. Start with you, Stephanie.
Sure. I'm Steph Herman. I'm a wildlife biologist and oil spill responder during the day, and at night I write, mostly speculative fiction. I do have a book out, and it's called Kingsmark, and I have coupons for a free book. If anybody's interested, you can come get one.
Free books.
Hi, everyone. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm a professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. I teach courses in fantasy, science fiction, creative writing, and others, and an author, first novel a couple of years ago. I have a graphic novel, Icarus, coming out this year, and I just signed a three-book deal with the Ed Greenwood Group starting for next year, and short stories in various places. And the other hat I wear is that I run a podcast with Brad Bollier called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, which interviews and talks about the work of artists and editors and authors from across the speculative field genre, and you can find that at speculatesf.com.
My name is Nina Post, and I'm the author of seven books, including Danger in Cat World, which is 99 cents today, if you'll let me say that. And I write YA, mystery, thriller, fantasy, etc. But okay.
I'm Harold Gross. I write science fiction, some horror, some fantasy. I've been an analog, FNSF, mostly all short story stuff out there, a bunch of anthos. This last year, actually, I had on Pseudopod, for those who go for the podcast, a story called Wriggling Death, which made some of the 2014 best podcast lists, which made my day. And on the side, I'm also a bit of a movie freak. I have blog up at haroldgross.com, about 1,100 reviews at this point, all spoiler-free, which was why I started the thing, because everybody kept asking me what the heck to watch, and I got sick of repeating myself, because I had about 200 a year to the blog. So, go by. Have fun.
Okay, hi, I'm Kevin Scott. I'm a writer, editor, and publisher. About 50% of my time is dealing with fiction, and I co-own a publishing company called Odd Rocket in Seattle. We just releasing a book this weekend called Demon's Apprentice by Torrey Santani, and I have some cards, so do grab one of those. It's a fabulous book. The other 50% of my time I work commercially, I write commercially for large companies, and I raise that because you can procrastinate just as much in that space as you can in the fiction area, I can assure you. So I'll hopefully talk a little bit about both.
My name is Jennifer Brozek. I'm an editor, an author, a small press publisher, and a game designer, and as of like an hour ago, officially Hugo-nominated editor. I do have a table downstairs, including my latest fiction collection, Apocalypse Girl Dreaming. I have nonfiction books on writing, and I do a lot of dark speculative fiction. I have an autograph session next up, and I have convention story cards if you want to come by. I get murdered horribly at every convention, and I ask the internet how I should die. So they get very excited about it. So this is the flash fiction that came out of it.
I'd like to actually organize this panel into two sections, or two categories, awareness and system. So we'll spend about 15 minutes on awareness. If you'd like to stop procrastinating, you should be aware of what's really getting in your way. So let's talk about the emotions behind procrastination, fear, anger, and shame.
I feel so bad about myself.
Yeah. And you're angry about it, too, and it's, you know.
Let's start with fear. Fear you're not good enough, fear you're lacking somehow, fear of failing, fear of disappointing people. What advice would you give to someone who's struggling with fear?
As an editor, I have an answer.
Yes.
As an editor, and I do accept I have an open call right now, it is not your job to tell me no. Your job is to write the story. You may have exactly the story I need, and if you look at this and say, it's just not good enough, I am afraid, then you are doing my job for me. So think of it that way. Your job is to write, it is my job to see if it fits the apply for. And it's okay to be afraid, but it's not okay to let that stop you from writing and submitting your stuff where you need to.
I'm fascinated to know what people are afraid of in this context. It's interesting. I'm just trying to process the thought myself. I guess when I think about it, as I've written over whatever it is, 15 years I've been writing seriously, certainly early on I was very concerned about what people might think if they were actually exposed to what I really think. Because when you get into writing, you're actually, you know, you're expressing stuff that you don't necessarily tell people on the bus. Certainly stuff you don't tell your mom, right? This was one of my big things. What happens if my mom reads this book? It's got sex in it. It's got a bunch of... Mom, I've got a kid, but I still, you know, somehow think my mom doesn't know I do that. So I think a lot of it for me would be I'd be wanting to think carefully about, you know, why am I afraid? What am I afraid of? And get a bit specific. I think a lot of this, you mentioned awareness. I think a lot of procrastination can be overcome if you understand what it is that you're doing, because it's not as simple as just I'm not going to bother today. If something's holding you back and you can somehow mine what that is, you're going to have to be a little bit honest with yourself. And the one thing about this is you don't actually have to tell anybody else what you're afraid of, but if you can at least get in touch yourself with what you're afraid of, that might be a starting point, I'm tempted to say.
Now, it's interesting. I was going with the classic fear of the empty page, but I hadn't thought about fear of the actual subject matter, which I've been caught by, and I was yelled at by someone for not just writing the bloody thing. You can't edit yourself. Fear is, it's the fear of putting something down and God forbid somebody should read it. You can always not give it to anyone. But anytime you write, you're practicing. Anytime you write, you're improving your skills. So it doesn't matter what it is. So you should just do it. You can always delete it if you think it's just, you know, way too out there for anybody else or reveals a part of yourself you don't want to think about. But that's actually an interesting kind of fear. I hadn't thought about that one.
One of the things that I run into when I talk to my students about this, I often get a similar question, which is about writer's block. And they ask about, you know, I just don't know, I feel like I want to write something and I don't know what it is. I've always been of the belief that writer's block as such doesn't exist. What writer's block is a stand-in for something else. It is a proxy for what you're actually afraid of that's keeping you from actually producing stuff on the page. And what I often talk about with my students is, I think my students oftentimes are afraid that what they have to say has already been said. You know, they walk into this conversation and they feel like people have been, you know, chattering about for thousands of years now. And, you know, what are they going to add to the picture that's new? Occasionally I have a student who thinks that their conversation is so important that they ought to stop the convo so they can listen to them. That's more rare, though. Most of the time what I get from students is this concern that they don't know what to add. And that leads to many things, including procrastination. They don't want to turn in an assignment. They don't want to get a workshop completed. They don't want to be part of a group exercise because they're afraid that they're going to have something that they won't be able to, what they have to say will already have been said. And one of the things that I try to make clear is that if they avoid becoming a part of the conversation, what they are doing is cheapening the field generally. That is to say, every aspect of who we are is critically important to add as a part of the conversation. And so what I would say in this context is, if what you're doing is avoiding producing something because you're afraid that it's not new, that it's not interesting, that it's not unusual, those are concerns, first of all, that all writers have had since probably the beginning of writing. And secondly, you will never know that until the material actually gets out into the field and begins to become part of that discussion. And over time, what you find is that as students start to produce this work, they begin to relax a little bit, for one, and they begin to realize that even if they're not saying something astonishingly completely different and new, the way in which they say it, the unique experience with which they bring to bear what it is they have to say, changes it and makes it so that people on the other end do see it as something that they might not have considered before, simply because of the person who's saying it to them, not just what it is that's being said. So a lot of it, I think, is sort of working through that fear of, it's okay if you think other people have said the same thing as you. You have not said whatever that is. And to be able to get that out initially so that the feedback and the process of communication can begin, I think, is critically important.
Yeah. I think a little bit of fear is natural and inherent in the writing process because, you're exposing something that's personal to you, and not only to other people, but you're exposing it to yourself. You're writing it down and everything. But I think it gets really unhealthy. And so I'm a perfectionist. And and I'm a planner, and I like to think about the future, and sometimes that can turn into worry, and how that manifests in my writing is interesting to watch, and it's definitely the source of a lot of the procrastination that I face. I just finished a draft a couple months ago of a book that, so it might sound a little weird, but it received a lot of positive feedback in its very early draft and its very early chapters when I was just putting it out there as kind of a testing sort of thing. And that scared me. I didn't realize it for a long time, but that was a really difficult book for me to write. I was stretching myself in a number of ways as a writer, and just in the type of story and the type of content that I was trying to portray. But really, I was worried about success, and that's silly, right? Because if you just sit down and think about it, first of all, the odds are astronomical. Second of all, it's not like it changes your life overnight. But I was sitting there, and I would come up with the stupidest, craziest things to worry about. I mean, I have a nerve injury in my hand, and I'm like, well, I can't sign the book then. Which is, like, really dumb and awful and sounds horrible, right? But the reality was I was just coming up with all of these little these little bursts of fear that I really wasn't recognizing that I was worried about something. And if you don't recognize that it exists, you can't then think about the reality and sort of present yourself with what the truth is more subjective or more objectively, and maybe talking to other people about it and stuff. So I do think that fear is real, both the fear of what if I'm not good enough and what if I am good enough. I think both of those things exist. And if you don't have that, though, not even a little bit, I think the quality of your work might suffer in the long run, because you're not worried about, in the end, being able to turn on that editor and see what can be improved. So I do think that there's a spectrum, and I think there's paralyzing, and I think there's healthy, and I think there's totally oblivious. And I think you want to be somewhere in the middle. But that's just my opinion.
I just wonder if anybody on the panel have you written other things to avoid writing the thing that was bugging you?
All the time.
Okay. Sure. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I have 3 or 4 projects going at any one time, because, one, I don't get paid if I don't work, because I'm a full-time freelancer. And two, if I have trouble writing something, it usually means I've made a mistake somewhere, and I have to think about it. So I work on something else while the hindbrain kind of thinks about why I'm having a problem with it. And I usually goes back to, I took the wrong step in the story, or I have a giant plot hole that I have not yet seen, but part of me has. So all the time I work on multiple projects.
Yeah, I work on a lot of different stuff, and when I was in that one particularly very bad procrastination mode for that one my one book, I wrote all sorts of other things, and those actually turned out great, and I'm really happy with the work there, because I was doing it as kind of a throwaway exercise, like, I need to write something, I'm not writing what I need to, I'm just going to do this for fun. And those turned out great, so I think sometimes turning your attention can be fantastic, but it does depend what you want to do. I never would have finished that draft if I didn't sit down and say, okay, why is this so hard, and how am I going to make a plan to move forward?
I think it's a good point to also look at the way that you sort of engage in your work process and what it is for you. I used to be, because I come from an academic background, I worked at a very sort of linear, bullheaded, must get this done, because when you're in graduate school, you know, you have to, or your advisors tell you to leave and without the degree. And so, you know, I needed to finish what I needed to finish. I do this class, I finish this, this is done, and then I'm able to do the dissertation, and I do that, and then it gets... and the problem is that in the writing field, especially when you're working in creative writing, your brain generally doesn't work this way. You know, at least mine doesn't. It doesn't work in the way where it says, you know, thou shalt now complete this plot before thou goest to the next thing. There are times when I just wasn't, you know, in that particular mode, and it was helpful to be able to go somewhere else, as you say, and write something to kind of a palate cleanser, you know, to clear my head from what it was I was thinking about. Robin Hobb has talked about this. We interviewed her a few months ago, and she had mentioned she does much the same thing. She has these little notes where she keeps sort of fragments of ideas that she's working on and keeps them in a drawer, and if she gets stuck in her main project, she opens the drawer and pulls out a fragment and writes a new story. And that's indicative of the fact that your brain sort of works in this somewhat nonlinear fashion. If I had stayed with this, I must complete this, that would be more likely to lead to procrastination than anything else. And the other benefit is that sometimes if I want to avoid grading midterm exams, I can procrastinate on those by working on my actual fiction. But just saying. But you know, the idea is that I think having a different project that you can turn to, at least a different mode that you can turn on, helps rather than just I must, you know, bash my head through the wall repeatedly, because that will also lead to this procrastination issue.
Well, that ties into another emotion, which is anger.
Yeah.
And that can involve being too self-critical. So that's very much the same thing.
Yeah, for sure.
It could also be letting others demand too much of you, or retreating into comfort zones and busy work. Is this familiar to any of you? What kind of advice would you give to someone who's too self-critical or tends to kind of default to their routines and busy work instead of what they need to be working on?
Two answers to that. One is get over it. The other, I mean, the simple one, actually, and it's the one that I had to use for myself, because it's easy. I mean, it's like, well, I need to vacuum, or I need to clean the kitchen, or
exactly.
Food sounds good. but what I mean, in my particular case, the way I got around a lot of the issue was I made writing my job, which meant I put in a structured schedule. And regardless of whether I was able to write word one, I had to sit in front of that bloody computer, not play games, not surf the internet except for research purposes. But I had to be there for X number of hours. And that was the forcing factor. And what it did is it's similar to state-dependent learning, is if you can get yourself into a rhythm so that you're always sitting in front of that computer at a particular time or in front of your pad of paper or whatever it is that you want to put it out on, is that you get into that mode very quickly. I got to the point where I was able to apply that for commuting on a bus. Mm-hmm. I had a 40-minute bus ride each way every morning. I wrote 2 or 3 novelettes, sold all of them, just writing back and forth on that, because as soon as my butt hit the seat, I had trained my brain and my body to just write. I'm not saying I used everything as it was there. Oh, God, no. But I got words on the page, and if you have words on the page, you have the basis from which to carve out whatever it is you want to have at the end.
And I don't know if anyone has heard of Mer Lafferty or her podcast, I Should Be Writing, but if you struggle with this, that's a great one to listen to, because she talks a lot about this. One thing she likes to say, which I enjoy also, is you're allowed to suck. And you can tell yourself that, and if you need external validation, I can tell you right now, you are allowed to suck. That's what revision is for. Mm-hmm. You don't need to worry about that. So when you're writing, if you hit a point where you're looking at it critically and going, oh, this sucks, you can start to talk to yourself and just say, that's not for now. That's for later. I'm just going to keep going. I'm allowed to suck, and you can't tell me I'm not. And it's sort of, you know, it might sound a little weird, but sometimes that's all you need, is just to remind yourself that you are writing for the sake of writing, and that no one gets it perfect the first time around. It's writing is all in the revision, if you're going to talk about how good it is.
In journalism, that's called fixing it in post.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Fixing it in post is my mantra, especially on fight scenes, because I have to really block out the fight scene. What I do is I put it in giant red, in brackets, fight scene here, so-and-so wins. And that's it. That's all I do. Because I know I will fix it in post when I have my gargoyles and I'm trying to figure out who's going where when, so that I don't have an extra leg and an extra person, or I'm missing a person. Fix it in post, make it your mantra.
The not getting blocked by details is a really important, it's a square bracket solution. It's, again, in fact, when I write collaboratively sometimes with Eve Gordon, and the first story we ever worked on, she handed me the copy, and it was going along, and there was nothing to do, and nothing to do, and I got to this point, it says, description of alien goes here. It's like, oh, okay. But it's, if you don't allow the description, if you hit anything where you go, oh, I need to do research, or I don't know how the choreography needs to work, just square brackets with whatever has to happen, move on. It saves you all kinds of excuses to stop.
So there's a question over here, did you say that?
The switching modes. Mm-hmm. How the hell do you do that? Because I write code for a living, and I write creatively, but it's the same part of the brain but used in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
It takes about 3 days for me to switch from one to the other, and in the meantime, the stuff I'm producing either side is crap. Yeah, I've used bad writing, I've used bad code.
Yeah, I can see non-linear coding would be problematic. Let me hit that from another angle, if I may. Because one thing you might be doing is if you try to switch from one mode instantaneously to an entirely different mode, or even not instantaneously, but as fast as you can, you will often find that your mind will be, you know, that's the sound of your mind shifting from fifth to first without a clutch, right? And so what I think often is helpful then is to have some kind of intermediate position. So for example, in my case, I mentioned that I do the podcast with Brad. One of the things that's very helpful about that is that the podcast is tied into writing. It talks a lot about science fiction and fantasy writing specifically, and we interview a lot of major people in the field and discuss their work, but it is not me writing at that moment. And so if I happen to have a moment where I'm like, I'm not, this whatever this scene is not working for me, one of the great benefits of doing a regular show is that I can take some time and focus instead on, first of all, talking to people who do get scenes right all the time and the people that we're interviewing, but also because I'm chatting with a writer, not about my specific work, but about the genre, about writing in general, that gives me a moment of transition. And I find after that, I'm then able to slide into something else. Now, in your case, it may not be a show that you run, but there are other ways, other creative avenues, perhaps going to, I happen to love Cirque du Soleil. I don't care who knows it. I love Cirque du Soleil. I find it incredibly creative and fascinating, and I love to go see that. I love live theater for the same reason. Live theater, which has nothing whatsoever to do with a lot of the stuff that I write in genre, but it's still within the creative field, and I find just by being immersed in creativity without it being my creativity or even my specific genre is a way for me to transition from one place to another. So if you're finding there's a big disconnect between what you do in one side of your life and what you do in another, having a bridge between those can sometimes help too.
And the trick there is also consistency. So I mean, if you can't do something that big, if it's a crossword for 15 minutes, whatever it
sure,
is,
yeah.
But don't expect it to work the first time or the fifth time. Or I mean, give it a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and the brain is incredibly malleable and trainable. If you can just get it to find those gears, if it's in multiple steps or a single step, you will eventually be in. It just takes a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's much.
I tend to do soundtracks, music.
Soundtracks are good too.
Sometimes, actually, if you're working on one thing and then you need to work on something else, to switch hats, I get up from the computer, I put on a particular soundtrack that reminds me of what I'm going to go do, and I walk. The physical act of walking, or gardening, or crocheting, can start training your mind into, okay, I'm listening to this thing, I'm switching from here, this is where I'm going.
Seems to me like the theme that's emerging here is impose some kind of structure, and I think if we took a straw poll of the room, I bet there's 20 different reasons why people procrastinate. I bet there's 30 different ways in which people procrastinate, and I think we've got to be self-aware, all of us. If we're creative people, the likelihood is that we're not completely structured people. I've seen models of, psychological models that argue that those two are direct opposites. It's actually quite unusual to be creative and structured. So if you're going to work your way out of a problem and you're a creative person, you're going to have to find some mechanism and some repetition, because to that point, mm-hmm. you can retrain the brain, yep. but you've got to retrain it through practice, through, I'm going to do this thing at 9 o'clock in the morning every day and somehow create a pattern for yourself.
Real quick, before we get to system, which we'll cover in the second half, the third emotion that can cause procrastination is shame, which can involve envy, imposing unrealistic expectations on yourself, or neglecting your priorities in favor of what someone else wants. Kevin, you wrote Shackled, so you must have some wise counsel to give about shame.
I'm shamed of my book. I'm not really.
No.
I've got to tell you, I don't know that I've necessarily experienced that emotion. When I procrastinate, I get the impression with people I know, there are people who kind of macro procrastinate and there are people who micro procrastinate. Mm-hmm. So some people will put off their work for a week and do something completely different. Other people will create a window of time to do work and they'll open up the laptop and they'll just go and make a cup of coffee. And then they'll go back to their laptop, and then they'll just check an email, and then they'll just check Facebook, and then, that thing. And I do the second of those things, and I don't really... Shame doesn't particularly resonate as a driver for why I do that. I think it's just... I don't know what it is. It's just a habit, and it's back to the thing I just said. You know, I get in, it's a negative habit, and I have to try and find positive habits to break that pattern. Because I'm not short of time to write. I'm lucky enough I get to write full time, but I can still fail to write for hours on end.
And we'll get to more of that soon. Yeah. Yeah. What about like professional envy?
There's jealousy, and then there's envy. Mm-hmm. Andy Weir is a very good friend of mine. I used to game with him on a regular basis. At the time, I was already writing, and he was doing comics, and he could not understand why he couldn't get a story and say, I want you to fix this. Don't tell me why it's broken. I want you to fix it as the editor. I'm like, that's called a co-writer. You know, that co-author. It's not. And he had tried for so long to get an agent and to get The Martian out there. He's like, he finally said, you know what, screw it. I'm just going to self-publish it. A year later, he came back to me and asked, would you edit this for me? Because there's a whole lot of typos in there. And I had to say no because I was busy, and I sent it to a friend of mine. 6 weeks after that person edited it, Crown picked it up. And he's got a movie, and he's super popular, and he's well-known in the genre. And it's bigger than I've been doing this for 10 years, and I'm sitting there going, I really want that. But I am not jealous of him having that. I am envious of it. And this is something writers all really need to work on. And it goes with the shame, because if you have the jealousy, you also sometimes have the shame of being, you want what that person has and you don't want them to have it. So you kind of, there's a lot of jealousy and envy that you work with. Shauna McGuire is a good friend. I am envious of her success, but at the same time, I am so happy for her. And these are feelings of inadequacy and jealousy that you may use to procrastinate in your own work. I will never be as good as Andy. I will never be as good as Shauna. Don't do that. You probably won't, but you'll be as good as you and better. So there's shame that goes along with the envy and the jealousy, and you have to crack it open. You don't have to tell anybody else, but you have to acknowledge it. And having done this for a long enough time, that I did have to go, wow, Andy, I never thought, Andy, I am envious. But you know what? Good on him. He never gave up, ever.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple kinds of shame that we might be talking about, like kind of two different things, because there can be sort of the secondary shame where you're putting so much pressure on yourself to meet this goal, or to, you're holding yourself to a high standard, you're ashamed that you have not met those high standards. I think there's also primary shame, which, so I can't really speak to personally, but some people might have these internal dialogue going on. Maybe you've heard it from your parents or from the culture you grew up in, where you're told writing is not real work, or writing is not important, or what you are doing is wasting time, or any of those little sort of very, very negative views on what you're trying to do, and then therefore you may be ashamed of your work. And I have met people who struggle with that. Now, I don't actually have any solutions for you, because it's not personal for me. But if that's true, you may want to look into addressing that, because it is important, and you should try to do that. But the secondary shame, I think, a lot of times is about recognizing yourself as human. I mean, you're not always going to meet your goals, or you're not always going to be this pinnacle of perfect success, and everybody's path is different. So if you're measuring yourself against someone else, you're measuring yourself against this illusionary vision of what you want to be, that can bring these shame feelings, and that's just a dose of reality, and maybe a little dose of humility as well, to recognize that you you're a human being, right? So
I think there's actually a slightly different variation on that, which is if you've got a partner of some kind, and there's a guilt and shame of taking those hours and disappearing and writing for hours, possibly until after they're asleep or till after they're back, and just you don't tend to get to see your partner for however long it is while you're trying to get it done. And that one gets tough, particularly depending on how open your conversations can be and how much you can work that through, because it's a drive and a need that you got to do. This is something that structure can help with, because if it is possible to work at times where perhaps that leaves you those hours. But if you're on a hot bend and you're really there, breaking your concentration isn't fair to the work either. And you end up in a kind of very bad cycle, and I've watched it actually destroy relationships and marriages and all kinds of horrible things if it doesn't get dealt with. But it is, I know I always feel guilty when I'm working and not doing those other things, whether it's friends or my partner or whatever. So
that's really interesting. I multiple levels of shame I hadn't thought about. This is a writing panel, right? There's two things that I wanted to touch on, actually, other than to say that, first of all, yes, and I have also a 7-year-old daughter, and I have to be... she's been enormously helpful, actually, in grounding me, because there is nothing that reminds you of what is far more important than someone who, in a way, loves everything about what daddy does, and in a way, couldn't care less what daddy is working on as long as he's being a daddy. That is tremendously important. It's allowed me to tap into an emotional reserve, which has made me a much better writer after a birth than before. The thing I want to say about the two things about shame, though, number one is the voice in the head, because I did get this from my parents. They were perfectionists, and they wanted me to be a perfectionist, and it had a pretty serious impact on me, and it's one that it's taken quite some time to work through, and I haven't totally gotten there, but it's, you know, a work in progress. Those voices in your head, I think you need to recognize, and I think it's very, very important to do this as part of what we've been saying throughout the panel. It is a voice which is not you. It is a voice which is something else. It is a part of you. It is representative of a person who had an influence on you in your past. It is a voice of a previous version of you that you like much less than the person that you are now, if you follow what I mean. That voice is not you. And it's important to keep that separate, because it doesn't mean, therefore, you should ignore it, advice that I've heard before. Just ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. That's nonsense. If someone is poking you in the side repeatedly, you will not forever ignore them. At some point, you'll be like, stop poking me in the side. Right? You will react at some point because you were a human being. Rather, you need to understand where the voice is coming from, recognize who that voice actually is, and therefore put it in the perspective that the voice belongs in, which is to say, you're here, you're at the side of the room, and you will eventually fade into the background as I listen to the much more important aspects of the real people around me, the voices outside my head, my own sort of internal ego that tells me, you know what, I'm not a terrible person and I can produce this work. So being conscious and aware of those voices, I think, is important. Important, and knowing where they stand is important too. And the other thing I just want to mention, sort of tied in quickly to that, is something that I heard from Toby Buckell actually a few years ago, which I think is enormously wise. Readers have a much different expectation from you than you do. And if you take nothing else from what I've said, take this from it. Readers want you to succeed. They do. Readers want to read a good book from you. They want you to do well. You should take great strength from that. Nobody goes to a production hoping that they're going to see something that sucks. No one is going to open a book going, I hope this person falls on their face. They don't. They are sitting there waiting to be amazed. And readers often will be amazed much faster than you will be, which is why we sometimes react to other writers and we'll be like, how is this book actually succeeding? And someone's like, well, I really love the book because I'm a reader. That is significant. And I think it's significant because it means that the bar that you have to clear is not as high as you may think. So that perfectionism that keeps you back and keeps you from saying, you know what, I actually have to produce this work, keep that in its proper place and recognize what readers really want from you is you producing a good story, and they are working with you to produce something between your writing it and their reading it. And I think that can help you as well. They're on your side, ultimately.
Going back to something you just said, Stephanie, let's talk about habits for a second. And you talked about kind of harmful habits of thought also. Have any of you changed a harmful habit or modified context cues to, like, create a new habit?
I just recently did this. I used to get up and I did something I called the internet tour, where I would check all my different emails because I, you know, all the different, is anything on fire that I actually have to pay attention to? And then I would go and look at Boing Boing and Cracked and Tor.com and four different comic books, and about an hour and a half later I would be done with my internet tour, and then I'd go get coffee and such like that. And then I went away for a week that I had no internet at all. And I came back and I realized I had missed almost any of it. So I went to my regular RSS feed and I deleted a bunch of it. And I still allow myself an internet tour, but I actually make that as part of my procrastination breaks. Mm-hmm. I have little webcomics to go and look, you know, Wire Geek and questionable content and such like that. But I don't start with the internet as a entertainment tool. I keep it off and I write first, especially under deadline. And then when I need the brief breaks, then I go and look at my internet tour. But starting with the internet actually is probably the worst thing I ever did for my productivity. So I am stopping that.
So I had this terrible habit of, well, not terrible, but I had a habit of opening my computer, getting Scrivener up and running, being like, I am going to write, and then just sort of sitting there for a while, not doing anything, because I hadn't put enough planning in to know exactly what the next part was, or I was a little worried about, like, oh, if I do it wrong, you know, something awful will happen. So one of the things that I do now is when I sit down for a writing session, I actually use a program called Write or Die. I don't know if any of you have heard of that. Don't actually die. But it's, so Write or Die is just, there's an online free version and there's one you can download for like $10. I got the one on my computer so I don't have to be connected to the internet. And what it does is it gives you motivation to basically, like, you have a blank page, you type. If you stop typing, then the screen starts to turn red or sounds start playing and you can't make it go back until you type again.
Oh, the horror.
And
remember that thing about shame? I just want to...
Much nicer version called Write a Kitten. And every 500 words...
It's Written Kitten.
Written Kitten. You get a new kitten picture.
That sounds awesome.
So if you combine these, does a kitten die if you stop writing? I just want to make sure I'm clear about that.
Write or Die, I looked at, and the idea of it shaking the screen or erasing what I've written,
So there are some scary settings that I will never touch, but I let the screen turn red because what it does is it gives me a kick. I set it for like 5 minute period, and I don't write on something that I care about. I just write to get the fingers moving.
Yes.
So for me, that taught me that when I sit down at my computer and I open that program, I'm going to be writing, and I'm not going to just be sitting there. The other thing I do is I do some pre-preparation where I actually think about what I'm going to write when I sit down. So I have a day job. I can't get up and just be like, okay, today is about, you know, and plan it all out. I have thousands of other things I need to worry about, including my day job and whatever traveling I'm doing. So those minutes or hour with my computer is really important to me. I need it to be productive. So those two tools have worked for me, but they are scary, and don't ever do the deleting your words part, because it will delete your words if you sit there long enough, if you let that setting stay on.
Actually delete your words?
It will start deleting and taking it away. The idea is that if it takes a few words away, you have to retype them and it will get you going again. But it's scary because you're like, oh, it's going away, and then the whole thing is gone.
Just this image of this high-stakes video game when you're failing.
It's a variation on an old exercise, which it with electronic horror attached to it. But the idea is, you know, one of the scariest things is an empty page, or not knowing where you want to go, or not knowing what you want to do. And one of the ways I was always taught to get out of that was to sit down and just start writing, even if it was, I don't know what I want to write today, so I'm just going. And you free flow it, and eventually what happens is your brain kicks in and you stop writing whatever that is and you start writing something else. And it's really just about getting the brain flow going again and getting past those initial hitches that stop. That just sounds evil to me.
but
it's not for everyone.
No, I mean, and the truth is, whatever works for you, that's cool. Just don't put it on my computer.
the pre-writing thing, I think, is very important. That idea of, I think a lot of people don't do that. The sort of mental preparation before you can sit down and actually sit at your laptop and write is, I think, very significant. Now, one thing that everyone always recommends is to carry around a journal or something like that. That's certainly true. But even beyond that, I think mental preparation and thinking in your mind, because you're doing it all the time unconsciously anyway. We walk around as writers and we think about, that would be cool to put in a scene. I would really love to see that. That moment of dialogue is really interesting. Wow, I wonder if I could do something with that. Those are the sorts of things that if you mentally prepare and set yourself up for it, you will hit the ground running much faster than you would otherwise. The habit that I used to have, which was a terrible habit I made reference to before, was this feeling that I had to finish something that was to be done right now, and then I would finish that and put that away, and then I would move on to the next thing. And the problem was that because I am, you know, a an author and a professor, technically I'm never off the job. You know what I mean? Like, there are times when I could just be home. I could be doing something. I could always be doing something. And as a consequence, it was very difficult for me to prioritize. And everything was ultimately important. I had fires to put out everywhere, you know. That was disastrously bad. And so one of the things I tried to do with was sort of creating a new habit was to literally be able to give myself the space to say, I don't need to grade that now because it's not due for 2 weeks back to my students. Don't grade it now. I know that it came into me chronologically first. It doesn't matter. I don't need to do it right this second. I do, however, want to work on my novel because even though that's due 6 months from now, I have a scene that I'm really interested in doing and I want to get that out and produce that first, and so I will work on that. So the point is, I learned to not only prioritize, but to let go things that I didn't need to do right that second. And that's important because there's no judge that's saying, you know what, you got this first and that second, and I'm sorry, you didn't do that properly, so you have to go to the back of the line. This is not a deli counter. You don't have to think about who got the number first. It's up to you to make a decision about what priorities you put where. And so getting out of the habit of first this, and making my mind not so damn linear was a big part of trying to break a bad habit that I had.
And if you find that your mind is linear, I can tell you something I did really early in when I first started writing seriously was, I think we all know what time of day we work best. And I realized right. that the company I was working for, who were paying me, you know, quite a lot of money, were getting that chunk of my day. And I made a conscious decision, I'm going to take that part of my day and put it into creative writing, and then the company can have all of the rest of the day. And so I just happened to be an early person. I wake up early, I go, and I saw I was going down to a coffee shop, spending an hour every day writing, because that was the best of me. If I took that into the office, the company would get the best of me. If I stayed out of the office and did my own thing, then my writing got the best of me. And that gave me huge momentum. And the reality is, maybe I got slightly not so good at my job, but nobody noticed. So, you know, seriously, giving yourself permission to create is a big deal. And, you know, we're in this environment, we're all creative people. Let's all give ourselves permission to prioritize our creative work first. Because if you don't, nobody else ever will.
Right.
So that's an important step.
Right.
And how about the rest of you? Adapted a system around your energy levels and your priorities.
I do my best writing early in the morning or very late at night. And the difference is, if I'm having a problem with the scene, I understand often my internal editor. So I don't start writing until 10 or 11 at night, and I will go until I am done. Because usually the editor is too tired to poke at things. Early morning, is when I get my drafting done. I write as fast as I possibly can, constantly thinking, fix it in post, fix it in post. And I try to flat it to the page is what I call it. And if I have a problem getting started, and it does happen, I have timers, 15-minute timers, either a big hourglass, it's really pretty, or a really freaking annoying little blob. Boxing, and I'm like, you have to write for 15 minutes. That is all you have to do. And then I will write for 15 minutes. And most of the time, that's why I use the hourglass, I will forget it's there and I will just keep on going. But if 15 minutes hits and I'm like, no, this is terrible, no. I will realize, okay, maybe today's not the day for that, or maybe I need to do a late night session. But my hint, my hourglass and my ugly, ugly $10 or $5 like little box that goes ee, 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 ee. and they're 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 60, and 90 minutes. You know, those are all good little tools. But I like the hourglass because it appeals to the creative side of me. I have a 45-minute hourglass too.
So I want to talk just for a second about the value of outside influence as well. That's a good technique if you need to be self-motivated. One of the things I found was for about 10 years, I wanted to be a writer and didn't really write anything. And occasionally I would start something and I'd put it aside and then start something else and put it aside. But it changed when I fell into a critique group. And I joined a critique group and suddenly there was a set of people who once a week were expecting me to show up with something. And then number two were reading it and saying, you know what, this isn't so bad. And suddenly that created a lot of momentum for me. So if you're not someone who shares your work, I strongly recommend at least try it and see how you respond to it. Because I found I responded to that very differently to what I expected. I wanted to hide my stuff away, but when I started getting regular feedback, that was the fuel that got me through writing a complete novel. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about patterns. With procrastination, you can look for a pattern. Is it situational or across the board? Jennifer, you do something really interesting.
What's that?
You track all of your writing and editing work.
I do.
Over the course of a year.
I did for a year because I'm a full-time freelancer.
Yeah.
If it was with freelancing, and I'm not talking the non-freelance work, or the reading of the novels, or the research, I tracked how many words per day, what job I did, and did it pertain to being a freelancer. Interviews count, giving a blurb counts, because all of this takes time. And I found out that I looked at my email 279 days out of the last year. And I worked 353 days. I did something on my freelance job and realized that was too much. And I'm trying this year, it's not working, to take one day off a week where I don't do anything. I'm trying, and because I do need rest. But if you keep track of what you do, did I edit something? What did I write? How many words did I write? Last year I wrote 373,000 words. And I published, got like bought, sold, 323. And then the rest I ended up selling this year because it's my job. It is my job. I don't have any other job. I will admit that I don't have a day job. But a lot of writers, you don't have, if you have a day job, don't quit it because it gives you the structure you need. But keeping a log of what you do every day will make you look back and go, oh, I actually did work. This is work.
You know, more importantly is that it helps you identify the stuff you don't need to be doing and where you do actually have time to write. Because the biggest challenge, I have a day job as well, and unfortunately I have one that has a lot of responsibility and hours because I'm dealing with offices around the world. I've lost my slot, and I've had to start tracking it because I'm trying to figure out where the heck I can slot in that extra hour or something where I can get work done, even if it's only once a week. Because my week literally starts on Sunday. My only day off is maybe Saturday. And so it's very important. The log can be really revealing in ways you just can't even imagine. You start figuring out where you've spent all of those hours and days, and you might be appalled.
If you're interested in seeing that, on my blog, there's a tag called Freelancer Summary, and every month I posted it for last year. I actually keep the log now, but I don't post it, because sometimes I need to go back and prove to myself that I'm actually working.
Yeah.
I understand. I wrote over 300,000, and I'm going, am I doing any work?
Yeah, sometimes it's easier to look at what's not done than what you actually have done, and so it's a silly system, but I like it, as I give myself pretty stickers every time I finish something. Even if it's just, I edited this, like, two paragraphs of a short story. Yay, I got a sticker. But it's rewarding the behavior I want to see in myself. I work with animals, and so a lot of times when you're working with animals, not the wild ones, but the domestic ones or the tame ones, it's all about the rewarding and asking for the behavior you want. So I like to try to be positive about it, because otherwise it gets overwhelming to be like, oh, I only wrote 500 words today, and there are so, like, thousands and thousands of words to go in this project. That's not a great way to frame it. It's so much better to frame it in, I went to work today, I edited this little thing, I wrote 500 words, and list off all the things you did do, and then you can feel good about what you're doing, and you're going to actually find out you're doing a lot more than you thought, because you do need to break it down little, or else it is overwhelming, I think.
And it's also helpful then to be able to help you in the future, not as sort of a, this is what I did that was wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. Rather than being sort of buried in the past, I think it's useful to do exactly what they've been talking about as a way to set up a new system you can use in the future. Here are the patterns I have. Mm-hmm. Here's how this will help me going forward, as opposed to, here are the patterns I have. Oh my God, what a disaster I am. That is not what you want, right? You want something that will continually push you forward in terms of what you do now. So having the information mm-hmm. is really useful. Just as important, though, is taking the information and then doing something with it, whether it's coming up with a system of using the stickers, I love that idea, or whether it's something else that is going to be specifically useful to you. That's what you use it for. You use your history to inform your future, not hold you back in the past.
And at the risk of stating the obvious, I mean, sometimes you need to shatter some of those habits or you need to shatter a way through. If you haven't tried NaNoWriMo as a way to shatter all of those habits and to build it in a huge way for a month and then figure out where it actually fits in your life, that can be a very powerful way to do it as well, because since it's got all of the outside influence and you're posting your word counts and you're getting all of this positive as well as shaming feedback if you can post no words, it can help.
Tell people a little bit about it, because they don't know what
it is. Does everybody know what NaNoWriMo is? If you don't, it's N-A, oh boy, I can't spell out of my head right now.
NaNoWriMo, I think.
Thank you. Basically, it's National Write a Novel in a Month, and it happens every November.
Mm-hmm. It's now got two camps as well, so it happens.
Oh, that's right.
In June.
Yeah. Right, I forgot. I remember they just announced that a little bit ago. Yeah, you literally just go to their site, sign up, and they have created all those tools to make it happen. And so if you haven't tried it or if you haven't heard about it, at least check it out. It can be really powerful. I know people who've completed multiple novels on it and that they only write in November.
And if you are like me in that you actually like to spend time and write a little bit slower and you end up with better work that way, it's still really useful. NaNoWriMo sometimes gives a bad rap because it's so fast that what you're turning out is pretty messy. But if you go into it with the right expectations, it can be fantastic for the whole write every day, learn to ignore your inner editor, just get the words down. But that doesn't mean you have to always work like that either. It's a great exercise. And so when I first did it, I came out with a novel that I can't even begin to approach revising. I mean, it is a disaster, but it taught me a lot to try to do that. And I don't think I would not be where I am now if I had not done that. So it's great, and there's a fantastically strong, if you're local, there's a really big group of people and a great support network for you if you want to do it here.
With NaNoWriMo, I highly suggest you that when you're done with the manuscript, it's your 50,000 word outline. And now you know what the story is, and now you can actually outline it, and now you can actually write it.
Yeah. We need to wrap up?
Yep, no. Pretty close.
Okay.
Any questions or comments? Or
like NaNoWriMo, you have 2 minutes to come up with a great question, Kyle.
Well, I have kind of a question and insight. So my question is, when you get that rejection letter, what do you do to keep yourself moving? One thing that kind of helped me, I don't know if they still have it at the EMP downtown, they have a sci-fi museum, and they had pictures of rejection letters from famous authors. One of them was letter to Tolkien talking about he's this amazing academic, why is he wasting his time writing fairy tales?
Yep.
And then the one from Martin was like, too much sex, great story, too much sex. But I didn't know if you guys had thoughts about how you overcome those.
So I try to keep my stuff out perpetually. Okay. So if there's a rejection letter, I just send it back.
Okay.
And I have a list. I do this ahead of time because when I get the rejection letter, I don't really want to think about what next market to send it to so they can just reject it. So I have a list of where it's going next,
okay. And
then I just send it back out. But that was an exercise I started about a year ago that I found really helpful for sort of wearing down that sort of rejection reaction.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with that. Don't let it even hit the desk.
Mark,
right back out.
In our critique group, you're expected to come in with a couple of rejections every week. It actually is, it's part of the goal is to bring in rejection.
That's good.
Rejections tell you that you're doing what 99% of the authors out there aren't doing.
Yeah.
So they're badges of honor.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.